It's golf today on a Tuesday, and conflict continues in the Middle East this week following Saturday's joint strikes by the United States and Israel against Iran, which led to retaliation by Iran and unrest throughout the region. More than 800 people have died in the conflict, with many more injured or displaced. Among those affected live golfers in Dubai. Let's welcome in Brently Romine with more on that story and the golfers currently stranded. Brently.
Yeah, George, as many as 8 live golf players remain in the Middle East as they try to get to Liv's event in Hong Kong, which begins on Thursday. Now, the X outlet Flushing It has reported that those 8 players are Laurie Cantor, Thomas Dietrich, Sam Horsfield, Anirban Lahiri, Tom McGibbon, Adrian Meronk, Lee Westwood, and Caleb Surratt. Now, I reached out to a few of those players and have been able to communicate with Surratt, the 21-year-old who turned pro out of the University of Tennessee a couple of years ago. He said he traveled with his wife, Kayla, to Dubai a few weeks ago after the event in Australia to get some preparation and before heading to Hong Kong. He said, quote, the last couple of days have been terrifying, but since then it's been okay. He's trying to get over the border into neighboring Oman right now, hoping to catch a flight out of Muscat that connects through Thailand. But if he doesn't do so in the next 12 hours or so, it seems unlikely that he will be able to make his Thursday tee time. Now, Flushing It added that other players are hoping to get on a similar flight out of Muscat, while others are hoping for a direct from Dubai straight to Hong Kong. Now, the U.S. State Department, as well as urging U.S. citizens to leave the region via commercial flight, even as the airspace remains partially closed at this time. Now, I reached out to Live Golf and their comms team, and I have not heard back or any information, but I have been able to contact one of the players who is expected to be a reserve on site just in case players cannot tee it up. He said he was en route, but couldn't provide me any more information at the time. Now, George, this is obviously a harrowing situation for these guys who remain in the Middle East, and I'll be working the phones and trying to bring updates all day as we see if they can make it to Hong Kong or at least get out of the Middle East.
All right. Thank you, Brently. We'll look for those updates. And the Middle East has been a home for high-level golf as recently as last month. In February, DP World Tour wrapped a 4-week stretch in the Middle East, 2 events in Dubai and 1 each in Bahrain and Qatar. And this story is going to continue to develop throughout the day. We'll have more with Brently on Golf Central. Stay with us. Golf Today returns after the short break. And Jim Furyk, kind enough to join us on Golf Today. Jim, golf fans have been familiar with you the last 30-plus years. Decorated PGA Tour winner, major champion, FedEx Cup champ, Ryder Cup captain. Are they now going to see another side of you as an analyst?
Well, yes, for API, for the players. I'm excited, actually, get to kind of sit on the other side of the mic and get to talk a little bit, you know, with some friends. I mean, got a great group with Terry Gannon, Steve Sands, Kurt Byram up in the booth. So I know all those guys pretty well. And I'm going to enjoy the conversation, talk about something I've been doing, as you said, for 30 years. Hopefully add a little fun to the game, add a little bit of just knowledge of what I've been doing for the last 30 years and maybe what's going through the players' heads as they're out there competing. And, you know, we all know Bay Hill is a difficult golf course. The setup's always tough. And so anxious to get out there, watch some golf, and talk off with some friends.
I'm curious, was this a no-brainer for you, Jim? Was there any trepidation at all? Why would you want to do this? Golf's been a huge part of your life, and I'm just fascinated why this is something you'd want to take on.
Yeah, I haven't been playing much. Last year I was injured. I had a hip replacement. I played 1 golf tournament. I've kept myself busy with some golf course design work with Furyk Golf Design. And but, you know, I find myself watching TV on Sunday evenings. I like to see how the tournaments shake out. Last week at Cognizant was amazing. Tough finish for Shane, but really an exciting finish for the viewers. And so I think, you know, the opportunity arose to kind of give it a try, to kind of dip my toe in the waters. And I thought it'd be a lot of fun. I'm definitely not taking it for granted. I know what you all do is very difficult. I know there's a lot of preparation that goes into it, but I'm excited to give it a try. And as I said, you know, we talked about it. You said 30 years. I think I have a lot to add to the broadcast. I think, you know, we'll see how it goes. I'm excited, but I know it's a lot of hard work, and excited to get to it.
You're a voice in the game that's very accomplished and carries some weight. As you've been preparing for this, and I know throughout your career you were meticulous inside the ropes, are there any other voices either within golf or other sports that you've looked at from an analyst perspective and said, hey, you know, that could be maybe a style or a style potentially that would resonate with you?
Surely there's folks you love to watch, whether it's baseball, football, golf, whatever it may be, your favorite sports, there's folks you like to listen to. I think really you kind of, my guess is a lot of it's going to be trial by fire, right? You're going to have to hop in the seat and kind of figure it out. There's not a lot of practice that you can do to get ready for it. But, you know, I really feel like you have to be yourself. And hopefully that, you know, I was a guy that when I played, I was very serious. I didn't smile a lot. But I think my friends know me as very lighthearted. I like to kind of dig the needle. I like to have a little bit of fun. So hopefully that personality comes out. Hopefully the fans see it. And, you know, as far as preparation, yeah, I was a guy that really, I heard a lot of folks say that they felt like when they got to an event that maybe I outworked them preparation-wise. And so kind of, I think I learned that along the way, right? I played practice rounds with Tom Kite. I played practice rounds with folks that I really felt were very prepared and kind of learned along the way what they were doing and how I could add to that. And so, you know, I think working along professionals, you know, Steve, Terry, Kurt, I think folks that have been in the business for a long time will be a huge help and surely have some things to learn, but I've been doing some homework and trying to get ready.
Jim, there are viewers who absolutely love this game. They're passionate about it. They play the game. How do you plan on informing them? What would you like the viewer to learn from you?
I just think about a little bit about maybe what's going through a player's mind on certain shots, trying to describe more than what they can see, why it's happening. I think, you know, when talking to Tommy Roy, the producer of both NBC and Golf Channel, really giving the viewer an insight to what's going through a player's mind and why things are happening for a reason. Why is everyone missing this putt low? And so I think, you know, talking golf, giving a little bit of knowledge about what I know about Bay Hill, what I know about the game, what I know about tournament golf. And again, really kind of leaning on a team, right? You, like I said, I've got so much experience in the booth and just have a conversation and talk to my buddies about what we're seeing out there.
Let's spin it ahead to this week at Bay Hill. You got three events on the PGA Tour named after a player: Arnold Palmer Invitational, Byron Nelson in May, the Memorial tied to Jack Nicklaus. When you think of the King, what are the memories that come to mind?
I think I remember the first time I ever met him. It was at the believe it or not, it was probably my second year on tour at the AT&T out at Pebble Beach. But I think more than anything, and I think you look at his storied career, you look at what he did for the game and for the PGA Tour. But I think it's really how, you know, when I think of Arnie, I think really of how he treated people, how he would look you in the eye, how he would shake your hand, how he would make a total stranger feel so important and just make him comfortable. And he just had a knack for that. And surely that's why he has the name the King. There's only one and only Arnold Palmer and just an amazing person in the game of golf.
Oh, yeah. Made everybody feel like they were 10 feet tall. Speaking of earlier in your career, Jim, I'll never forget being in a reporter's scrum 2004 U.S. Open at Shinnecock. We kind of corralled you by the practice green, and you kind of joked, like, since you'd won the U.S. Open the previous year, it's as if your IQ went up by 50 and suddenly you were the smartest man in the game. How did that U.S. Open victory kind of change your life in terms of the things you've been able to do, but also the eyeballs that were on you from not just for the fans, but from the media who would constantly be knocking on your door?
Yeah, surely it changed my career. We're always going to be, you know, you talk about my career and how many wins on the PGA Tour, and then you're going to go immediately to how many major championships, how many big events were won. And so that U.S. Open, I let a lot of major championships slip by, you know, got beat by some great players, maybe made a few mistakes down the stretch and let a few slip, but surely that's my greatest victory. And yeah, I always used to joke that, you know, you win a major, you show up the next week, and there's just a lot of eyeballs, a lot of pressure, a lot of mics in your face, all of a sudden starting to ask you about worldly events instead of just what's going on in the game of golf. And it kind of made me laugh. But I think at that point in my career, I was already 9 or 10 years deep into my career. I was a rookie in 1994. I won the U.S. Open in 2003. I think it was about my seventh win or so on the PGA Tour. So I was established. I was really comfortable in my own skin. Making that step wasn't a giant leap for me. It wasn't something that I had to get too comfortable with. And so I'm kind of thankful that things kind of progressed in my career. You know, I got from college golf to professional golf relatively quickly. That happened fast, but the maturity process and the success kind of came at a nice even keel and a nice pace where I never felt overwhelmed or I never felt like I had to live up to expectations, which can be very difficult for a young player. So, you know, a lot of guys go out there and maybe win quickly or win a major quickly or in their career. And it kind of throws them for a loop and makes it difficult because that expectation builds up so high that, you know, they try to live up to it. And then I really only had to live up, you know, I was my toughest critic and I kind of lived up to the expectations I had of myself, but really never felt that pressure from the outside. So I feel like my career kind of happened in the right progression. It was very fortunate for me.
Right time as well. And Arnold Palmer famously said, swing your swing, something that you did throughout your career. If you were Jim Furyk, the 15-year-old these days, and with the proliferation of video everywhere when it comes to teaching, swing instruction and analysis, could Jim Furyk 2.0 exist in present day?
I mean, I'm really happy with the way things went and the progression. I was lucky to have my father was my teacher. He really believed what became natural was repeatable and it would hold up under pressure. That if you had to break something down and rebuild a brand new golf swing, that under the gun, it might not hold up. And so, you know, what would I tell myself earlier? I probably wouldn't mess with my golf swing. It was my, you know, my thumbprint. It was unique to me, but I trusted it and I understood my swing. I think if I had to go back and young Jim Furyk, I probably would have worked out a little earlier in my career. I would have maintained and took care of my body a little better in my career. I was very lucky that I avoided injury for most of my career, but that side of the game, the bigger, stronger, faster, more powerful, more developed athlete, we didn't have those training techniques back in 1994. The fitness trailer was more a place to go to take care of wounds, not necessarily get ready for the next day. And so if I could go back, I think taking care of myself a little bit better, understanding the physical demands that were going to be put upon me in my 30s, 40s, into my 50s, I probably would have trained a little bit better for that and prepared better for it.
And if you were 15 now in 2026, do you think you would still have the same swing that you had?
God, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great? Everyone listening out there, that'd be nice.
But do you think your swing would be the same now in present day, or that with video at such a young age that maybe you would have had a different look with the rebirth of Jim Furyk?
Yeah, video was starting. I mean, the old camcorders and VHS, and I had some friends that through junior golf and through college that were real interested in video. It just... I think a lot of it's going to depend on your teacher. I think there's a lot of players on tour that their teacher is relying on video, but not necessarily they're going over and watching the tape. They're more field players. And I just wasn't that technical. I didn't want to know where my wrist was at the top of my swing. I wasn't connecting the dots. I worked through shot shapes. I worked through feels. And my dad and I kind of developed our own language as far as getting through the golf swing. And so I really don't. There are teachers out there that said, oh, man, if I could have got a hold of you at the age of 16 and we could have changed your swing, you know, maybe it could have been better. Maybe you would have won 30 times on tour and not 17. And, you know, maybe I would have won two as well. Or maybe I wouldn't have made the tour. And so you have to kind of look at it that way. I really think that I'm unique. I think my golf swing was unique. But I was very fortunate to have a teacher that didn't try to break it down, didn't try to change it, worked with my natural talent, my natural ability and athletic skills. And then we just tried to refine and hone in all those fundamentals that, you know, and every year just got a little bit better. But I had a lot of friends that joined the tour, guys that we were rookies together, second year players together, that would watch a Nick Price or a Nick Faldo or one of the best players in the world that had a beautiful golf swing. And they immediately said, well, they're the best player in the world. Their swing looks perfect. I have to swing like that. And a lot of those guys quickly disappeared from the PGA Tour. So I think I was just very fortunate that once you're that age, once you've ingrained a swing, and I left for college and then into professional golf, that's your golf swing. And you got to make the best of it and play with what you got.
Jim, before we let you go, a lot of changes happening at the PGA Tour, discussions, signature events versus smaller PGA Tour events. getting out of the shadow, perhaps, of the National Football League, new leadership under CEO Brian Rolapp. Your thoughts on what you're seeing as the PGA Tour tries to, you know, keep up with the big boys in the NFL and Major League Baseball, et cetera?
Yeah, well, I don't think anyone's keeping up with the NFL. I don't know about y'all, but whether it's NBA, NHL, Major League Baseball, I mean, the NFL's king at the moment. So I don't know if we're really competing with the NFL, but I think I have a lot of questions, just like everyone else, just like you do. You know, there's talks of our tour shrinking to a smaller number of events. Maybe that's 25, a smaller number of players that would be exempt. My questions are very simple. Like, how do you get on said tour? How do you fall off said tour? I love watching, I loved watching Riviera. I loved watching Jacob Bridgman go out there and, you know, take on Rory McIlroy. Rory's trying to chase him down on Sunday, and the kid stood in there and made a great putt at 16. Still had to make a 3.5-footer on 18, knocked it right in the middle. But I love watching a young talent go on to win a golf tournament. And I like seeing fields that are 120 players deep at a minimum. It allows a young player and someone that has a lot of talent to step up to compete against the best players and go down the stretch and learn and win. And I think everyone wants to watch Scotty. Everyone wants to watch Rory. But seeing a guy like that come through and compete and win, and he's got off to such a great year this year. I think every event in the top 20 on the PGA Tour. So I love that part of it. And then I also worry if we go to a 25-event schedule, what happens for the other 27 weeks? There's going to be a silly season. There's going to be other tours, other folks that are going to try to get in there and lure the players in the playing. So I think more than anything, just learning more about it before I question it, before I say this won't work, I think just gathering more information, understanding where the tour wants to go would mean a lot more. And I think right now we're all kind of a little bit of a, you know, wait, hold, pause, and see where we're going before we can be too critical.
I think we're all in wait and see mode, and that'll be the next big step for Brian Rolapp in his new role as PGA Tour CEO, and excited to see your new role this week as part of the call for the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Jim, good to spend some time with you.
You as well. I appreciate you having me on. Thanks, guys.
Nice chat with Jim Furyk. Up next, we'll be joined by Brendan Porath from the Shotgun Start podcast. Get his thoughts on Jon Rahm's comments on his future with the DP World Tour and the European Ryder Cup team. We're back on golf today. It was the Europeans. Shane Lowry, victorious 2025 Ryder Cup at Bethpage Black, defeating the U.S. and Captain Keegan Bradley. The first victory on the road by the Europeans since the Miracle of Medina in 2012. Recall Jon Rahm had a nice week, 3-2, including going 2-0 in foursomes with Tyrrell Hatton. But his future for the Ryder Cup in 2027 in doubt as Rahm continues to refuse to pay fines to the DP World Tour in connection to his play on LIV Golf. Today, Rahm was asked about his future with the Ryder Cup.
Rory was a little cheeky when he came out with that quote about saying, you know, you'd been on the Americans about wanting to be paid. Now you had an opportunity to prove you would pay. Any reaction to that at all?
I think I responded to that a few weeks ago, and I said that statement would make a lot more sense if all 12 of us were being asked to pay, not only just the two of us. And there's more intricacy that goes into this whole situation, right? I mean, while I understand why he's saying that, I mean, we all do it for the love of the game. It's a different situation than what we usually say, right? Like, I'll gladly pay my way to go on the Ryder Cup, not have to pay to still be a member of the DP World Tour and fulfill the commitment that I'm fully willing to commit.
And time now for a Golf Today roundtable. We welcome in Brendan Porath from the Shotgun Start podcast. Always wonderful to spend some time with you. How about Jon Rahm saying that the DP World Tour is extorting players? I mean, extortion is a very strong term, obtaining services or money. It's an illegal act through coercion or intimidation. Your thoughts on what Jon Rahm had to say?
Oh, I'm having nightmares. It feels like I'm back in law school. You need to slow down with the definitions here, Damon. It's a loaded term for sure. And I think, you know, use the term intricate or intricacy involved. It's really not. It's pretty black and white. There were consequences to decisions that John Rahm made to go to LIV, which at the time was a hostile tour to the DP World Tour, a hostile tour to the PGA Tour. He talks about, you know, we should be able to be free to play wherever we want and play freely. That is not a freedom he enjoys right now on his current tour, right? He has to go play the contractual events, the 14 or however many live events. He can't get out of those events. He has to go play them. So he's contradicting himself quite a bit. I think when John first came out on tour, there was this notion, oh, he's sort of this hot-tempered. He did have a hot temper, but we confused it for maybe he's not bright or not reflective. He actually is super contemplative, super smart, really, you know, deep and enjoyable to talk to and listen to. When he came out, he just has a little bit of harboring some delusions about the consequences for going to live and the benefits of going to live. And we saw that a couple of years ago at Valhalla, trying to suggest the notion that he was still a member of the PGA Tour and still played on both tours. And I just think it's very black and white here. Everyone in the same station as him is paying his fines or paying their fines and making themselves eligible. They've sort of tried to meet him halfway here or even overcompromise and given more and more and more. And he's kind of dug his heels in. It is a little bit in the vein of Seve, right? Seve was this guy, and you know, he is this icon of the DP or the European Tour. But he went to battle with them. He butted heads with them frequently on the subject of fines, on the subject of rules controversies. It is a little bit in that vein, and I don't know if that's what he's trying to live up to, but it seems like a black-and-white solution he can quickly fix.
Is this only happening because it's an even-numbered year? Would this happen in a Ryder Cup year?
Well, that is, you know, that is the great question. What is going to be the staring contest? It is going to be a game of chicken, right? And who's going to budge first? Could we see John Rahm actually just forfeit playing a Ryder Cup next year? Could we see the DP World Tour stick to their guns and just say, we're better, we'll have 12 guys? We've seen them do that in recent years, maybe not with someone as high profile and someone who contributes in such a way as John Rahm obviously has for several Ryder Cups now, year after year or every other 2 years. So I do think he is able to be a little bit more bombastic. The DP World Tour on the other side is able to be a little bit more hard line in an even number year. And we'll see the rubber meet the road here. But it just feels like he's scoring an own goal here and hurting a little bit of his image, hurting his reputation in a way. Because what he's saying is just too contradictory and incoherent even sometimes. For someone who is so enjoyable to watch, enjoyable to listen to, and obviously is, I think, a pretty selfless member of that Ryder Cup team. He's maybe number one, 1A, the last two times out, but he takes a back seat, lets all the questions go to Rory or Shane or whoever might be the player of the day. He's pretty selfless as a Ryder Cup member, given he is absolutely one of two pillars at the top of the roster. It just feels it's an odd, puzzling sort of own goal here.
Yeah, and on that note, is there a chance that he potentially alienates some Ryder Cup brothers with his stance?
That, you know, there is a little bit of an undercurrent of that happening here with Rory, who was critical. Rory came out and was critical first of that decision in a, you know, diplomatic way. And Rahm has kind of pushed back a little bit on that initial criticism. I don't want to say he's ruining his reputation. I think someone like John and where he is right now, you learn to live with whatever it might be, you know, might bother you or irritate you or feel like you're not in line, rowing in the same direction, because he is so good. He is an enjoyable personality. He has been a selfless teammate in the past. Maybe there's some marginal sort of reputational hit with teammates, but they are putting on a platter for him to rectify things. And there will be maybe a hard feeling or two, but they'll learn to get along with someone like John Rahm.
We've been talking how ended 23 when John made that decision. It was 1A, 1B, him and Scottie Scheffler with what they had done in 22 and 23. And now Scottie has gone on this generational run the past couple of years on the PGA Tour with all the wins and the majors and everything he's been able to rack up. For Scottie, how long can he keep this going?
As long as he's eligible to play on the PGA Tour, I think that's the one thing that Scottie Scheffler has demonstrated now for more than just 6 months, more than just a year, more than just 2 years, quite frankly. I think we've seen it, whether it's at an American Express or the CJ Cup Byron Nelson. We've seen him. He's not a guy that loses interest in the competition, loses form based on the stakes, or gets sort of blasé or fatigued, laissez-faire with success. I think it doesn't matter what the stakes are. If it's a tour event, if it's a major, he's showing up to compete. And I think that consistency, that mindset, is indicative, and obviously the obvious skill, the obviously otherworldly generational tee to green skill is not going anywhere. And as how long can he keep it up? Maybe there's a year where he doesn't putt well, but 5-10 years, there's nothing super violent about his game. His footwork, you know, is quirky, but there's nothing violent about the game. And his mindset and his approach don't suggest anyone who's going to have some sort of deep drop off at any recent age.
Brandon, I had a very quiet Sunday at home watching golf. The wife was out of town. Kids were on the tennis court. It was just me hanging out with Shane Lowry and Nico Echevarria. I thought there was great value and drama in what I watched from the Cognizant Classic in the Palm Beaches at PGA National. Is there a place for a tournament like this, bereft of a player in the top 25 in the world, but still compelling television on a gorgeous Sunday evening?
I think so. I think it was amazing television. It was a combination of Shane Lowry obviously being one of the more prominent players in the field, being on the lead, the venue, the Bear Trap plays well for TV. You might get exhausted by the mentions of it, but it plays well for a reason, right? There is that sort of television product anxiety and intrigue as every player stands on the tee, whether it's with the 3-shot lead or chasing. So I think, you know, some of these weeks they're going to have to figure out, are they just a bridge from, you know, in this case, one elevated event or signature event to the next? I think there's a mixture there of a players like Max Homa, players who are looking to reascend to greater heights, players who live in the area, quite frankly, should play there. More should show up. I understand the conflicts and the heavy schedule going into the players, going into Bay Hill and others, but there's absolutely a place for it. It's a compelling television product. I think you just set the expectations and understanding of what it is. Is this a, you know, Nuggets Timberwolves game on a Sunday in March or February, or is it Nuggets Timberwolves game, you know, in June or May? So you set the expectations and enjoy it for what it is.
Speaking of setting the expectations, Justin Thomas making his return from that microdiscectomy surgery that he had last November. Number of guys who have had this surgery and have come back in recent years, reaching the same level has been a challenge. And Brendan, it used to be Tommy John in baseball with pitchers, ACLs with running backs in the NFL. We have this surgery. The advances that we've seen over the past 10 to 15 years with the Graham Dillette, Tiger Woods, Kevin Chappell, Will Zalatoris, what's Justin Thomas 2.0 going to look like going forward?
Those names, I don't know if I'd put advances in the same, use that term with some of those names, because we have seen some of those guys, quite frankly, not get back to the form they were or really struggle to be healthy. Hopefully, obviously, for Justin Thomas, it didn't seem as severe or as dire. I think the expectation for Justin is that he regains his form. He's too talented. He's too consistent, too competitive for him to simply drop off. He's obviously still too young as well. I know he's been around and doing it for a long time as a boatload of wins. To suggest that, you know, this is sort of a line of demarcation, there's no real coming back, it's post-back surgery, he's never the same, I think is probably a folly. And we'll see him get back to Justin Thomas, a mainstay on these American teams, whether it's President's Cup or Ryder Cup. I do think, you know, for him, it's less about injury. It's more about finding his place, finding his form, whether it's driving consistency or up on the greens. I have more of a concern about that and getting that form back than his health, but it will take time to certainly get back competitive reps.
What about Tiger, who said at the Genesis he did not rule out making a start at the Masters, but we did not see him compete at TGL, did not see him compete in the Seminole Pro Member?
You know, he dropped a line at TGL the other night that he could play a member guest. He's member guest ready. I think it was more as a deflection, like, I'm not ready to play tournament golf, but it is something. It's a morsel of, I can't even make a swing. It feels like he's, you know, dropping the breadcrumbs enough to make a run at playing in the Masters. Now, we may get to that week and he'll say no, but we're here on March 3rd and he's not ruled it out. And it seems like he's probably driving toward doing that. You know, someone even suggested, could you get a start in before that, whether it be, you know, on the beloved Champions Tour or maybe the PGA Tour? That seems unlikely, but it does feel like he's making a push to try and play the Masters. And we may get to that week. He's like, nope, not ready. But right now that door is open, clearly.
Well, he's the big 5-0. You wonder how many more opportunities he would have where the body could cooperate to play the Masters.
Right.
So, hey, it's certainly something we're going to be speculating about going forward. Brandon, always good to have you here with us on the Golf Today Roundtable. And always check out the podcast, the shotgun start that they have. And we got our podcast here with Golf Channel Podcast, Ryan Lavner, Rex and Lav. How good is that? Those two team up.
Boots on the ground.
We got the Golf Today podcast as well. Just a select sampling of our best interviews that we have. So make sure to subscribe to the Golf Channel YouTube page. We are back on the other side of this short break.
Time for a past champ chat with Paul Goitis, one of our favorite guests. Always wonderful to spend time with you, buddy. I was going through the microfiche in the archives trying to find the story from 96, and I was struck by the Associated Press headline. It said, Bay Hill Invitational won by unknown Goitis. This is the AP, not the New York Post. I thought it was a little bit of a tough headline. Was it as a surprise to you as it was to the Associated Press?
Yeah. Absolutely. There was nothing that said in my career up to that point that I was going to win at Bay Hill. Quite frankly, there's been nothing since Bay Hill that said I would win at Bay Hill either. It was just one of those weeks where everything, you know, everything went well. And I think I got a little bit of advantage that it was before the modern scoreboards, and I got to play two, three, or four holes at a time without knowing kind of where I was. I remember I saw a scoreboard after I birdied 14. I was trying to see who was leading, and it was me. So it was a different era at that time in the way things went around, but just one of those weeks where everything went well.
Your journey to get to that point was an interesting one. You turned pro, I believe it was 89, and it's been talked about. You were still doing some substitute teaching then on mini tours. You fast forward 7 years later, you're winning Bay Hill next to the King on the 18th. What was that ride like?
Again, it was almost surreal because, it was so unexpected. I think Johnny Miller made a point that when I was walking up 18, that my best finish in any event leading up to that was a tie for seventh at the Bob Hope, which had happened that year. It was a wonderful experience. The chance to have Arnold, you know, give you the code. He invited me to play a practice round with him at Augusta because I qualified for the Masters for winning Bay Hill a few weeks later. It's one of those experiences that just, it's the first thing I talk about. It was the best experience really in my golfing career.
What was that practice round like at the Masters with the King?
Again, it was a wonderful day. I think we played with Woody Austin and Fred Funk. One of the best parts is after the round, he took us into the Champions locker room to have a beer. And it's, you know, that's not a place you'd expect. I mean, I'm surprised I ever qualified for the Masters, ever went into the Champions locker room, and to sit in there, Sam Snead was in there with us. It was a wonderful day from the day I woke, to the minute I woke up to play the practice round, to have a beer with Arnold in the Champions locker room. He opened his locker and all the jackets are hanging in there. It was a unbelievable experience. It's really hard to, unless you do it, and I hate to say that, you can't imagine how wonderful an experience it is.
Well, Champions locker room and the Champions dinner on Tuesday at Augusta, one of the most exclusive clubs and coveted dinner invites.
Yeah.
You're a member of a club that's potentially even more exclusive, the Sub 60 Club on the PGA Tour, done 15 times by 14 different players. For those who haven't been in the, quote, zone, what's that like?
Yeah, if I could answer that question, I would do it more often than once, quite frankly. I talked to Annika Sorenstam, and if you talk to Annika, and I don't know her real well, but I got a chance to talk to her for about 10 or 15 minutes, and I walked away realizing why she won 100 tournaments and I won two. She talked about it being 100% in the present, meaning I needed to birdie 18 to shoot 59. My thoughts weren't the pins left. The thought on the tee shot was hit a good tee shot. There's no bunker. There's no rough. It's you aim it at the target and you hit it. The second shot, the pins front left by the water. Where the ball ended up wasn't important. That was a future event. Just hit a good shot. And I kind of, you're staying in the present where there's no future. There's no expectations. It's just you're 100% in the present. And that's the best definition I've ever heard of being in the zone. She seemed to think she could get there whenever she wanted to. I've been there once.
Well, you had the nickname Sunshine, kind of ironically. Yeah. Are there things you wish you could have done differently as you tell that anecdote? Or are you comfortable with your career? Do you look back and say, doggone it, I wish I had been more present?
Well, I don't know that. I think that it's a skill. I think, first of all, Annika's got a skill that I don't have. Tiger's got, Annika's got numerous skills that I don't have, and Tiger and Phil and all these top players. So there is a skill, which is fine, by the way. I'm very happy with what I have and what I've done with it. I think, part of the sunshine thing comes from my expectations didn't match my skill level. My expectations were that of Tiger Woods, and I had the career of Paul Goitis, which will make anybody kind of look kind of negative about things. But, look, and I'm now 61 years old, still playing the Champions Tour. I have, very little regret, and I have nothing but thanks and gratitude to the game, to the PGA Tour, to the fans. I mean, for allow a guy like me to be able to do this professionally since, the early 90s, I've lost track of how many years that is. I think it's in the 30s. I have zero regrets, and I what I have is gratitude.
Well, and there's not only to win on the PGA Tour, to win multiple times, but then to be able to have that long a career, that's a special skill set to have. And if you think to the early stage of your career, when you're first getting on the PGA Tour, what was your welcome to the PGA Tour moment?
I remember my first event was in Sony in Hawaii, which I happened to go on to win, 14 years later. And I was hitting balls on the range, and there was this guy hitting balls next to me, and he's hitting every shot perfect. It's really windy, and his ball's piercing through the wind, and he's hitting cuts, and he's hitting fades. And I look over at him, just kind of a glance, and I have no idea who it is. And I'm going, I don't even know who this, I don't know what is I've never seen this guy before, and he looks like he's the greatest player in the world. Well, it turned out it was Payne Stewart, and he wasn't wearing knickers. When he wasn't wearing knickers, I didn't recognize him. And so it was like when I found out who it was, I kind of screwed over the bag and took a look to see what he was. It was Payne Stewart, and I felt better about things. But I think that one of the things you have to overcome is standing next to people like Payne Stewart when you're a rookie and still doing your work and still being able to deal with the situation while you meet your heroes. Golf's a sport where you play for a long time. And I played 3 or 4 competitive rounds with Jack Nicklaus. So, you meet your heroes, you get to play against your heroes if your career is long enough, and being able to deal with that. It's a pretty interesting thing that first year on tour when you're seeing the people you've watched on TV the last 10 or 15 years playing golf.
Well, Paul, it's interesting. You won Bay Hill. So did the late, great Payne Stewart. I'm curious, Was it always a brute? I mean, the guys walk off the golf course these days and they look absolutely flummoxed, exhausted, occasionally confused, and already love to have it tough. But was it always a brute, even back in 96?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a much different golf course. I watch the guys, they're driving 10 now, and it's a different kind of problem now. Bay Hill does kind of ask you to hit it not only the right, just to hit a pin high. You need to hit a pin high a lot at Bay Hill. And if you don't hit a pin high, you get in trouble. And that, as the kids today hit it so much farther, they have such bigger gaps between their clubs, it gets a little harder to hit a pin high, I assume. But the golf course, there's a lot of challenges out there. And if you kind of get out of position, you get yourself compounding that problem. We tend to think we're supermen sometimes, and sometimes it's a take your medicine golf course and accept what it gives you that particular day. It's just a really good challenge.
Paul, I always enjoy your insights as it pertains to the state of the game or direction of the PGA Tour, history of the PGA Tour. We have Brian Rolapp in the mix as the new CEO. His first big move, more of a roster-related one with Brooks Koepka coming back. Now we're hearing the whispers of how the schedule may reshape in 2027 and beyond. Right. How do you think the PGA Tour should look to evolve?
Well, I think that we sometimes lose track that it's a business. You know, it's in the entertainment business. They're competing in the entertainment space, and we do need to attract sponsors and whatnot. And quite frankly, the people in charge, the Brian Rolapps, I like the board right now. Having Tiger on the board is a big deal. They know a lot more than I do. We can sit here and complain about things. But again, this idea that, you know, the football's very successful, and he's coming from a very successful place, and football has scarcity. They have one game a week, and they only play on Saturdays and Sundays, basically. My guess, whether we like it or not, the tour is going to get shorter, and you know, probably my guess would be, you know, like I said, a February to August type schedule. But you're going to have bigger purses. You're going to have more, the top players playing together more, and you're going to have to deal with the backside of that is what do we do with the journeymen who are trying to get out there. So they're going to have to grow the Korn Ferry Tour a little bit, make that a better place to play, and use that as a feeder into the PGA Tour. But out on the Champions Tour, we're pretty far removed from these conversations, but it sure feels like over the last X number of years, they would like to get away from running 45 tournaments on the PGA Tour. They'd much rather run 30.
Paul, we always appreciate a few minutes, especially reliving 1996, where you famously hit a four iron.
Born in 1996?
I was born. I was in grad school. Were you born, Savarinkas?
I was 11. I was becoming a PGA Tour fan then. A Paul Guido super fan.
How many? I played in the last PGA Tour event I played, and neither one of the guys were born when I won.
Yeah, we're a little longer in the tooth than the young pups out there. But, buddy, we appreciate a few minutes. Have a good rest of the season, huh?
Hey, thanks for having me.